Eastern Cancer Registration and Information Centre. In earlier life, working in agriculture, but now a collector of lots and lots and lots of data. So she's going to tell us all about, if you don't want to ask questions. And mind you, I suspect that tonight he may be hoping somewhat to get back to his roots and cultivate the weeds of the discussion group. So, with petals wide open, we await your talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm actually not the Eastern Cancer Registration and Information Centre anymore because we changed at the beginning of the month.
So
never mind. And I'm not actually a senior analyst anymore either, but don't mind about that either. So anyway, it's going to be a bit of a sort of whistle-stop, rather unstructured talk, so if you've got any questions, you probably better to ask them now, otherwise I'll have forgotten what it's about. Okay. Cancer registration started, or had been going up until very recently, as a regional system. And this is moving towards a national system, which I'll come on to. Basically what we do is we collect and collate an awful lot of information. We get, and again I see that coming, all kinds of different data sets. And the idea is putting them together into a single coherent data set so that people can find out about all the cancers and the other neoplasms, which are abnormalities, which are not malignant but are of importance in health terms, so we register those as well, like benign brain tumours, in situ breast tumours and so on. So that's what we do. And cancer registration originally started on the basis of looking for incidences of cancer which related to things like radioactivity, radon in Cornwall, and sort of radiation leaks and so on. So it started on an incidence basis, but we've, as things have developed, it's gone very much more into following patients through their lifetime, and although incidence is still important, moved perhaps more to looking at outcomes and treatment patterns and so on. We currently, in the east of England, have a population of 5.7 million, which has grown up over the years, starting in Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridge, and we gradually did a series of takeovers and took over the rest of the east of England. And as well as that, we have national responsibility.
Just on one point, does east of England extend into Lincolnshire?
No.
Right.
That's the East Midlands.
I bet the Lincolnshire people love that.
Well, it is my problem. No, it's Norfolk, Suffolk, Cambridgeshire, Peterborough, Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire and Essex. But not all of Essex, but not the bits in London. So, okay, about when I came to the cancer registry about 8 years ago, almost all our data recording was manual. That's people went up into the hospitals and recorded notes onto a piece of paper and gathered the information they had. The only electronic feed that we had at the time was from the Office of National Statistics, where they told us whether people had died, not they died, or everything else was manual. Over the last six to eight years ago, we moved almost totally over to electronic data, and now everything comes in as an electronic data feed and is automatically fed in to a database which is then checked off by people to see that what you've got is relevant to what you're looking at. And this is all being put together into a single database for England called Encore, the English National Cancer Online Registration Environment, which has the advantage that you can immediately find out if you're working on a particular cancer what's going on in the whole of England as opposed to just your region. And it's also much quicker. And in terms of what the likes of me do, we generate a monthly snapshot of the database. We could interrogate the live database, but if we spent our whole time trying to get data out of it, nobody will be able to get data into it. So it's better that we have a mirror database that is frozen every month. And it also means basically you've got a data set that you can work on, things don't keep changing all the time, basically. So this is sort of what it looks like schematically. This is probably not all the feeds, but I don't know if any of these need any explanations. These are what we get in. This, for anyone interested, this is going to be a project basically on genetic markers and so on, so that will be quite interesting in terms of individual data on different different genotypes. And that's basically what happens.
In your, as it were, base level database, you also have patient identification.
Oh yes. Yeah, it's all we work under now. I think it's when I last said it was section 251 of the NHS Act, which allows us to hold identifiable data.
Yeah. So you can locate the patient geographically.
Yes. Yeah, we both by, you know, we've got all their details and their full location. I mean, that remains confidential with us. It's allowed out to people who have good reason, like clinicians treating patients and so on, but not. But it's basically held very confidential. And an awful lot of the work setting this up was setting up the security, basically, so that it is the best we can tell.
What about quality control of the pathology and the original diagnosis? Because that's often the problem with these big databases.
Well, we will get multiple pathology reports. And we will get subsequent pathology reports. There is always a problem with supplementary path reports that they seem to get lost within the hospital envelope as far as getting to us. But we certainly do get them, and I certainly have one out with a clinician who insisted that the tumour was a certain type, and I managed to be able to be in the situation of saying, look 30 pages later on the notes and you'll find that it's been changed. And I was right and she was wrong, so it made me feel better.
Another point on the possibility of hospital notes getting mislaid or disappearing. Are you in a position, I mean, you said earlier that you follow the patient through their lifetime.
Yeah.
So this means that if you don't get a follow-up report when you're expecting one, you could prod the hospital.
Basically, yes, that's right. I mean, there are a series of... there's a thing called the Cancer Outcomes Dataset, which I wasn't going to mention, where basically the hospitals are checked up that they are producing the data that they're supposed to do. That's just in process of being rolled out at the moment. So that basically should do that.
What do you do with patients who migrate in and out of the country?
That tends to get some extent to the Office of National Statistics. They'll be flagged as being exit posted when, or perhaps if, their GP signs them off. Mm-hmm. If they come back again, they should be picked up by the system and we should get them back on again. But it is a bit of a difficult area.
Well, why did you phrase that in terms of the country? What about people who move in and out of your defined region?
Well, that's going to be no problem very shortly because it's a single national database.
Okay. including Scotland?
Well, they're going to complain, aren't they? So. No, Scotland is, I mean, I think Scotland was offered the possibility, but they didn't want to take it on at this stage. We've got very good data exchange agreements with them, so in practice it doesn't work, but it's obviously less straightforward. And of course there are an awful lot of people who move across the border for treatment back, I think, which kind of gets quite messy. Okay, and as I mentioned, that being electronic, we are quick. And this is how long it takes from the date of diagnosis until we first had a record on our books, if you like. It had it electronically recorded in the data set. And I was basically amazed, I'm not sure whether I must believe it, but it's quite impressive really how it's improved in the past 3 years.
Well, I was just looking at it in detail. Apart from the grey ones at the bottom and the black ones at the top, the other bars are pretty much a constant plane.
That's right, yeah.
So,
it's basically we've just shifted the whole lot.
Yeah, you've got more being done within 30 days.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
fewer being taken longer than 120.
Yeah.
But between 61 and 90, it's pretty much a constant percentage.
It is pretty much. It may be going up slightly. In that one.
Yeah.
But I mean within...
So it could be that you're pulling down from that very top one into the purple one.
Yeah.
But
in that this used to take a year and a half when I joined, basically, it's quite a spectacular improvement.
And you only got data for the 3 years, 2010 through 2012?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I'm just thinking that looking at the blue bars at the bottom, it looks pretty flat to me.
Well, the blue bars are, I mean, the thing is that we have monthly, sorry, I should have meant this, we have monthly data, basically the data comes in monthly chunks, we couldn't take continuous data. So the bottom bit is always going to be vague because, you know, it depends on what time of the month it was collected. Then it's got to be put together, then it's got to be sent to us.
Yeah.
So basically for anything to be in this bottom bit is quite an achievement at all, you know. And it's the sort of one above there, which where things start to be behaving much more consistently once you're into, once you've got a month and you've just got the smoothing out coming at the end. But that, I mean, just and after we've heard about it, we then go on collecting data on these people. So the data that we have is, as you mentioned, the patient demographics, name, date of birth, gender, postcode, residence, and then there are information on the cancers, neoplasm being a sort of the general term for the cancers and cellular abnormality. Behaviour is whether it is invasive or, if you like, a cancer. In situ, which is a cancer that hasn't crossed the epithelial layer. Benign, which is growing but not invading, not malignant, but can be a major problem if it's in a place where it presses on something and causes problems. Morphology is the cellular type of the tumour. Grade is the degree of de-differentiation or aggressiveness, and stage, which I'll spend much more time on, is how far the cancer's progressed. And increasingly, we're starting to collect, if you like, individual genetic type information, such as these list of markers that we've got here, and that's probably going to expand fairly extensively in the future. But we need
we really need this kind of thing to be fairly widely adopted before we collect them as a routine, otherwise you've got very patchy data. We collect treatment. Originally that was just whether they had surgery, whether they had chemotherapy, whether they had radiotherapy, but we're now, over the past 20 years, we've become much more specific, the type of surgery, type of radiotherapy. We're now moving on to all the dose rates of radiotherapy, the location of radiotherapy, type of chemotherapy drugs, and so on. The hospitals where they're treated, which on which we do a lot of work on how hospitals, what hospital outcomes are like. And we get the cause of death, we get both cancer deaths and people who are registered as having cancer and who die of other causes. Okay, this is some things that we've done with our data. First example is a very rare gynecological tumour, which we have, I think, about 300 or 400 a year in the country, 30 to 40 a year in the east of England. And it's almost impossible for individual hospitals to actually determine anything. That's the advantage of the cancer registries, because we've got large numbers. And basically, we were able to show that radiotherapy, where it had been used, had quite a spectacular effect on survival. It hadn't been used, I guess, for worries of what generally used for worries of long-term effects, but this is an extremely aggressive, extremely unpleasant tumour with very poor survival. And the use of radiotherapy actually basically doubled the survival. And I think that's now fairly widely adopted. I mean, I think the same thing was being done probably at in other places at the same time, but we found it, we never actually managed to publish it. The next one, we brain tumour some patients with terminal brain tumours do ask whether they are suitable as organ donors, and the most common brain tumour, there are worries about it crossing the blood-brain barrier into other organs. This one here, glioblastoma multiforme. So we did a national study, basically, and basically I found no transmission of any brain tumour. So currently, Addenbrooke's, I know, will now accept transplant organs from donors, and we're rerunning a national audit just to validate it, or we're involved in it, to see whether this, several other hospitals do adopt, see whether that this will be adopted nationally, because there's obviously a major shortage of donor organs. And we worked on the development using our data in developing a model called PREDICT, which is used by clinicians to look at breast cancer survival and determine the benefits of chemotherapy. And this is a public available both for patients and for doctors, and the idea is it's run together with them. So do you want to fill in the figures, or shall I? Any suggestions? Age of diagnosis?
42.
Well, that's a bit young.
Well, well, I can think of a 30.
What?
I said I can think of a 30.
I know, yeah. Should we go into the realm? I mean, I can do
55.
Sorry?
55.
55, okay. or detected.
Screen.
Not possible. It's below the screening age. Unless we're getting into the realms of BRCA positive genetics, which is out with this tumour size.
15
millimetres, quite small. Tumour grade. Here we go, grade 2. Number of positive nodes.
What does that mean?
Sorry, what?
What does that mean?
Okay, fair enough. as breast cancer basically starts in the organ, if it spreads into the lymph, basically into the axillary lymph nodes as the tumour progresses and then metastasizes to different organs, bones, brain and so on. So positive nodes make it mean that the tumour has progressed more and has potentially worse outcomes. So let's go for 3 anyway and see what we get. Now these are various genetic markers. Estrogen receptor status, which I'll take positive there because it has some more interesting effects. HER2 status, you've probably heard of Herceptin, trastuzumab. That is a drug that's specifically associated with HER2, with the specific effective on HER2 positive. I'll probably take negative here. This is a new marker, which basically is a cell proliferation marker, which is not yet in major use, so we probably put unknown on that. And the chemotherapy regime basically relates to the type of drug used, most mainly being used in the third generation, which contain taxanes, which are sort of extract related to yew trees. So let's go with that. We can get we get a survival prediction there. Now, what happens here is that one would tend to advocate chemotherapy if you had more than a 5% survival benefit, because chemotherapy is not nice at all. So this one, if you like, would probably be a straight example where chemotherapy would definitely be recommended and definitely be a benefit. But let's put the age up, say 65. And we're getting closer to this not being probably, if you like, being questionable.
What would the all causes mortality rate be?
These are the all causes mortality rates.
Right, okay.
These are not,
this is not
these are not cancer specific death
right,
rates.
Okay.
No, these are all cause mortality. So mortality due to the effects of the chemotherapeutic agent would be included.
Also road accidents or
well, yes.
Yeah.
If you bring in screen detected here, because we're now into the 60 to 74 screening age, we now find that you're at the stage of maybe thinking perhaps chemotherapy is possibly not worth it, the balance of the side effects against the survival and margin. Let's just go down to the bottom, probably it's not going very well on the screen. So you have an extra 3 basically 3 out of 100 lives would be saved by that. It's, you know, is that worth the side effects? That's clearly an individual decision you need to. And certainly the idea is that the patient is able to look at the data and make that decision.
That disclaimer at the bottom read as if anyone could do this online. Is it that?
It is, they can. You can just log in www.predict.nhs.gov.
David, how often is this updated in terms of outcome and so on?
It was developed 3 years ago. It's been updated. New models have been released pretty well once a year. I'm planning to run a new update on the same data set, but I haven't done it yet, which will be fed in. We gathered the original data about 3.5 years ago, I think. And it was then validated on another data set in the UK and a data set in Canada. And it's been evaluated on historic data sets as well. So I'm going to get back to you. Okay, moving on to the, I guess, sort of, hopefully the meat of the thing. And probably there are actually not, I thought there'd probably be more people here involved in clinical trials, and probably almost thought everybody's here more involved in population stuff, so perhaps this is not particularly relevant. But we are, with the Cancer Registry, we're clearly not in a position where we can use any kind of analysis of matched cases and controls. So when looking at outcomes, we use relative survival methods. And Peter knows far more about these than I do. But these are based on the probability of survival with cancer when compared with the overall population matched by age and sex, and the overall population includes people with cancer. We generally use the whole population of England, although we may use a life table for the subpopulations in certain circumstances. Now, relative survival is not perfect, and here I'm getting distinctly out of my depth here, but the ideal measure is net survival, which basically would be how much, if you could work out what the cancer, if cancer was the only possible cause of death for a patient, what their survival would be. And there's an awful lot of literature on it, and I basically just use the method that they made, but this is an example of it which can be looked up. And I'll work on, we record cancer at about 120 different body sites, if you like. But the big four, breast, prostate, colorectal and lung, make up more than half the cancers in England. So I'll concentrate on these from now on so that we've got reasonable numbers to work with. Just looking at the different methodologies, this is what we find. Basically, if you have crude Kaplan-Meier survival, quite obviously the curves go on downwards. The traditional relative survival method produces a much higher curve, which is basically the comparison of survival of a cancer cohort against their matched population, net survival,
tends to produce a slightly lower curve, and they separate further as you get older. The average age of diagnosis for breast cancer is around 63, so by the time you've got on to 10 years, people are nowhere near their life expectancy, but they are, I guess, not very young. Looking at prostate cancer, the graphs diverge much more and spread much further apart because the average age of diagnosis of prostate cancer is well over 70. So then when you're, obviously it's in men, you don't live as long anyway. So when you're up here, you're well into the 80s, probably reaching the stage where you're over your life expectancy anyway. So it's not surprising that the crude survival curve and the net or relative survival curves diverge even further. Colorectal cancer is a very, very different curve. What's happening here is that basically, while breast and prostate cancer are good survival cancers, they're not actually cured. Colorectal cancer, the curves here very much flatten out, which indicates a cure situation. And if you can, in about 50% of colorectal cancers by surgery, possibly in combination with other treatments, if you can remove the tumor, basically you can cure it. And roughly speaking, if people survive more than 3 or 4 years with colorectal cancer, you can largely say that they're cured, which is very different from breast and prostate, where the curves drop off gradually.
I understand,
yes,
the distinction between the black curve and the two colored ones,
yeah,
but if it's possible in simple words to explain it, what's the difference between the relative survival and the net survival?
Can you help with that, Peter?
Well, there are two different philosophies. Relative survival starts with a population of cancer patients and a matched fictitious population of non-cancer patients. And if you divide one by the other, you get a notional survival.
Okay.
Net survival is more looking at a hazard increase in each individual patient through modelling at a patient level.
Right.
Now, in principle, you should get the same answer because
you're modelling the
same thing. But there's all sort of housekeeping things about how we account for follow-up and biases in the estimation, which brings the curves apart. So I don't think, I could be wrong, I don't think there's any information in that gap. But there is information in the gap between the black curve and the other curves.
That seemed like a very helpful answer. Thanks.
And the reason for the big gap is?
Between
Kaplan-Meier and the other two.
Well, basically Kaplan-Meier is whether they died.
Yeah.
Now, if you like, you would have expected that they might have died anyway, you're going to subtract that from the Kaplan-Meier curve, so it's going to go up. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it goes back to Ted's original question of are you including all the other causes of death? Well, yes, you are in the Kaplan-Meier curve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Are you including? I mean, you. Yes, you are. And basically, you should. You're removing. Ideally, you're trying to remove all the other causes of death. In the net survival, it's supposed to be all the other causes of death as opposed to cancer. In relative survival, it's simply just comparing one with the other, I guess. Sort of.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, yeah, very close. You're better off using the net one.
Sorry?
Look at this figure. Looks very close. So we're happy with the net one.
Well, it seems to work fine in that sort of situation, but.
Yeah,
but in that, it obviously is not working as well.
Yes.
I mean, I suppose you're getting to increasing levels of uncertainty when you're talking about men aged. Let me just check the exact mean age for prostate. I mean, the mean age of diagnosis of prostate cancer is 74 years, so you're talking about 84-year-old people then, which is, I think, slightly over the life expectancy of this country anyway. So you're getting an awful lot of people who are dying of natural causes, other causes, whatever you want to call it.
And you can just about see the steps and the curves and the numbers are getting to see.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, moving on to the last one, lung cancer, which is an extremely poor survival cancer, and basically here, curves hardly separate at all. So, you know, a couple of months survival is fine for that, is frankly fine for that purpose. And it's a very, very poor, very, very poor outcome cancer.
This period shorter than those was 91 to...
Sorry?
92 to 2001. This one is 2002 to 6.
Well, simply because we had better data. Only things haven't changed that much. It was, I'm afraid it was just the data I had. And it didn't seem, basically it didn't seem worth going on much before beyond 5 years because it got so low anyway. The other ones, yep.
Is there a possible effect here of the diagnosis? Is lung cancer more difficult or less likely to be diagnosed in time than, say, breast cancer?
Somewhat. It's not... It is more difficult. And breast cancer is probably one of the quickest to diagnose. Perhaps a little bit, but it does seem to progress very rapidly when it's diagnosed anyway. That would only be a fairly small part of the overall difference, I think.
Right. Yeah, but possibly, I mean, I'm only guessing here because I don't really know any of the facts, but possibly it might only be suspected once there are fairly conspicuous symptoms like prolonged coughing or whatever.
Yeah, indeed. That's right. I mean, I guess if there was a... We're in areas that we don't know really.
What you're really asking is it worth screening?
Yeah, well, there's
a carcinoma of the lung.
Yeah.
And these data would suggest not.
There is, however, a screening trial going on at the moment, the UK Lung Cancer screening trial, which hopefully will answer these questions.
CT scanning has been shown to improve mortality in the States.
Sorry?
CT scanning in the States has been shown. Screening,
yes, I mean, the only question is with that is to whether the people that you're picking up by CT scanning actually, and I don't think you know whether those cancers would have progressed. This is always
true,
a problem.
True, yeah.
It's always a very difficult area. I'll be interested to see what the UK Lung screening trial actually generates. But yes, indeed. But you would expect that. But if you pick up a few people with apparent indolent cancers who you wouldn't have noticed anyway, that's going to improve the survival anyhow. It's a difficult one.
This may be a bit sort of arm-waving, but I have a sort of completely anecdotal idea that lung tissue is less able to heal, to compensate, than colorectal or breast tissue, and that once it's in there and it's taking stuff out, it's taking out areas of the lung, and there's nothing your body can do to compensate.
You're probably better able to answer that than me, aren't you, Richard? I don't
know.
No. I don't usually answer. It's certainly when lung cancer gets going, it is extremely aggressive.
There are not many treatments, actually, not many chemotherapy treatments. Surgery does, it depends on the size and aggression of the aggressivity of the nodule when you actually get it. Once the nodule is getting over 20 or 30 millimetres,
yeah,
it's very different.
I mean, I guess the question is that, yes, when there are solitary pulmonary nodules below a certain size, obviously
some of them are not going to progress and some of them are, and that's a question of identifying the ones that are going to progress and the ones that aren't going to progress. Yes, when they're up to that size, they're already...
Yeah, you do it by repeat scanning. I mean, if you see a small nodule, people don't do very much. So you look it again 6 months and see if it's doubled in size or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. So it's quite complex. So the screening would be a more complex process.
Does this include all types of lung cancer in here, like non-small cell and adenocarcinoma?
I don't know on that. Do you know how small cell behaves with solitary bulbar nodules?
With small cells, about 10 to 15 to 20% of the total, so it's probably included.
Yeah, or whether your SPNs actually are mainly on small cell, I don't know. Small cell is obviously extremely aggressive. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Sorry, I'm not looking for them. Okay, anyway, I think I've sort of covered on this anyway, explaining them. But obviously some people do an awful lot better than others. And what can we do to identify the better survivors? How can we sort of equalize our case mix, if you like, in making comparisons? And one of the main measures, which I mentioned earlier, is stage of diagnosis. And this, I'll sort of probably go back and explain again some of the things I've already talked about. You get these three measures in staging cancer, which is how far it's progressed, how far the cancer has gone on. And that's sort of what we were talking about with lung cancer, as to whether it was very early stage. And a single, very small nodule, where T describes the size of the tumour. If it's invading nearby tissue, and neither of those would have happened, it would be small, it would not have invaded nearby tissue. The nodules we were talking about actually are precancerous anyway in that example, but if we consider a small cancer that hasn't spread at all, that would be a low T stage T1 cancer. And as it gets bigger or progresses into other tissue, it goes to T2, T3, T4. The next one, N, is the extent to which regional lymph nodes are involved, and this is very cancer specific, so it's difficult to describe, but it's how many of the nodes are involved, where they are, how big they are, and so on, going to making a T score that's according to a cancer. And then last thing, the M score is whether the cancer had actually spread to distant regions, which bone, brain, liver, with a sort of regions to which the cancer often spread. And then that will, almost all cancers that have metastases are stage 4 cancers. Small cancers that haven't spread at all, obviously stage 1 cancers that have spread on that. So let's have a look at some survival by stage, and you can see, first of all, I'm sure everybody knows that you need quite big numbers to do survival. And this, we've got in this breast, this is probably made up of about 20,000 cases, and you still get some quite wobbly graphs. But you can see, first of all, that stage 1 cancers basically are on pretty much 100% net survival line. They do just as well. They're not dying of cancer, effectively.
And presumably all cases diagnosed will be treated.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we don't have any. Well, unless they refuse treatment. There will be some that have refused treatment in that.
Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but there will be very few of them, I would imagine.
Yeah. So basically, we're looking at, if diagnosed within stage 1 and then treated, very low mortality. But if not diagnosed until stage 4,
yeah.
then.
Very poor. Very poor. Yeah.
I mean, I noticed the all stages combined is a lot nearer to the top. It has to do with more people at stage one and stage two.
Well, it's driven. I mean, breast cancer tends to be an early diagnosed cancer, so the majority of diagnoses are within stage one and two, but there are a significant number of stage three and stage four cancers, which is pulling the line down a bit. You can see that it's pretty much a straight line. But that line there is the first 5 years of the line I showed for them all, you see what I mean? Except it's not the same years, but it's a slightly different area.
And it seems to me there's a sort of circularity there, that precisely because the survival is very good for those diagnosed in stage one, therefore most will be diagnosed in stage one because it's worth diagnosing them, and so therefore you get this predominance of stage one in the data.
It's also a relatively detectable cancer.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes.
People, women are frequently able to notice it, plus there is screening.
Yes.
And if, when referred to GPs, GPs pick it up pretty quickly. Prostate cancer, again here, because of quirks of the staging system, stage one and stage two are actually both early stages, and they're grouped together. And again, stage one and stage two are pretty much 100% survival. And again, your all stage line still follows a pretty high level, stays pretty high. Stage three is a relatively contained cancer. Stage four is not.
A stage not known one is interesting because it also has a very high mortality.
But a lot of these will be very old people who probably who it was not felt
worth digging in.
You said it. They would. Yeah, I mean, there will be a few that are not diagnosed by biopsy. I mean, the biopsy is not exactly a vastly pleasant experience, you can imagine.
There is a suggestion that stage not known, in fact, is a fair approximation to stage four.
Yeah, we tend to find that it falls between stage three and stage four in most of our cancers. I mean, certainly it has been said. It depends on how good you are at looking at the staging data.
Yeah.
You've got a few, you've clearly got, you know, some people who are probably, if you like, very late stage, and a few people who are perhaps so old that, you know, it's not, because the stage is simply not determined because they're so close to.
There's that interesting very rapid dip at the beginning.
Yes, I don't know what's... hang on, the very rapid dip there will be, first of all, the ones who were effectively terminal when they were diagnosed.
Yeah.
So it was not, you know... They clearly had prostate cancer, but no treatment was possible. And the cancer wasn't staged because, if you like, there was no point in staging it because they were clearly going to die from it very shortly, I guess. No. That's a fair point. Now, I haven't sort of remarked on that observation. That would be my interpretation.
Are these the Kaplan-Meier all causes of survival?
These are not Kaplan-Meier. They are... No, these are net survival.
Yes.
So these are survival due
so
to the cancer.
So there wouldn't be any confounding with difference in age, that the stage of your cancer when you were diagnosed.
There shouldn't be, no. But obviously, if you've got a particular cohort, what I'm saying is that this curve probably splits into ones who are not staged because they are so ill that they're going to die very shortly. And here you've got sort of some that are
at the end of it, perhaps, who are very old and are not staged and who are basically close to their expected natural mortality. I guess, you know, sort of with people aged 100, I don't know, I'm not going to do biopsy and staging. Yes. Colorectal, again, you've got the flattening curve for there, and you find here that stage one is not quite staying at 100% survival, not far off. Stage two is quite a bit lower. Stage three, again lower. Stage four, extremely bad. And interestingly here, the stage not known almost perfectly mirrors the stage. Well, that's one where it does, but we just have to be spot on. It's not the only one where it is. And lung cancer, I mean, even stage one cancers do pretty poorly. I mean, that's sort of something equivalent to stage four prostate cancer, probably. So it's still not good news. And the stage four survival curve drops off so much we can actually can't follow it from that point. And it's a very smooth curve, stage four. There are a lot of stage four cases. Okay, so just a sort of a bit about that stage is kind of in the news at the moment. It's one of the things that has a strong approach to try and improve cancer outcomes in this country by diagnosing at earlier stage. And these are just a couple of statements by Mike Richards, who was the National Cancer Director, is now the National Director for reducing premature mortality, of which 40% is due to cancer.
What does it mean to say that it saves 10,000 years of life? I mean, they're all going to die sometime anyway, so in what sense of their lives? Because it does mean they're not going to die this year, would they?
They tend to use, they're not going to extend their lives by 3 to 5 years.
Right.
It's the sort of figure that's used. Yes, I mean, years of life lost would be a better one, but life saved.
Better for our better on the Today programme.
Yeah,
but you're absolutely right.
But no, you're absolutely correct, yeah.
The most common fatal sexually transmitted disease is like birth.
Thank you.
But that middle one, or rather the second one, there's something lurking beneath that. If inequalities by age, gender or deprivation were to be eliminated, what, for instance, would be driving inequality of diagnosis by age, or inequality of diagnosis by gender, or by deprivation?
With deprivation, uptake of screening, perhaps less awareness of cancer systems, symptoms, particularly some ethnic groups. By gender, as an example, women tend to be diagnosed much later with bladder cancer because bleeding is mistaken for menstrual symptoms. There are, you know, those kind of things come into it. With age, GPs tend to expect lung cancer in older people.
Yeah.
Lung cancer actually tends to be diagnosed as a slightly earlier stage in older people than it is in younger people. It's very counterintuitive, but it's...
Yeah. Well, and maybe your GP might recommend you to screen when you visit or something.
Well, yeah, there's no screening for lung cancer.
Somebody
aged 50 goes in with a persistent cough, they won't send one for chest x-ray. Somebody aged 70, they will.
Yeah.
Straight off.
Yeah, so in the case of lung cancer, if a 50-year-old has it, that's an inequality against.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, there are these kind of differences for various, either biological or socio-biological reasons, I guess. And I mean, to some extent, it's something that is achievable. I mean, if you've got one portion of the population that is able to be diagnosed at an earlier stage, it should be relatively feasible to extend that to other parts of the population. Whereas treating some cancers is a long way away. This is something that should, in theory, be achievable. And I mean, when we published a paper on one occasion on inequalities, and it went to an American reviewer, and the reviewer said, "This is absolute rubbish. There's no inequalities in England. They've got the NHS."
Huh.
Fortunately, the other four reviewers didn't have the same view, so we got the paper in. But you know. So. Let's have a bit of a look at survival over time now. And if we're looking at, I mean, survival for most cancers, but not all cancers, has improved over time. And basically, if we're considering stage, we could either have, we know that earlier stage cancer has better survival, so an improvement in survival over time could be due to a high proportion of cases diagnosed in earlier stage, or if treatments improve each stage, you could get improved outcomes for each stage. So let's have a look at the cancers.
Sorry, you said that some hadn't improved over time.
Pancreatic cancer has hardly improved. Lung cancer hasn't improved much.
So they're generally staying stable rather than.
Well, it's generally extremely poor, basically, some of the extremely poor survival cancers haven't improved. Probably something like thyroid cancer, which is extremely treatable, hasn't actually improved over time because it's always been very treatable. Survival's always been extremely good. Treated with radioiodine has been for a long time, and that's extremely effective. So you've got either very poor or very good, but most have improved. So looking at breast cancer, we find, first of all, looking at the black curve, quite a marked improvement in survival over time. But looking, there seems to be a sort of difference between the stages. Stage 1 and stage 2 tumours have improved in survival, but really, when you start splitting them up, things start to get very messy and your graphs go all over the place. But basically, it doesn't look as though stage 3 and stage 4 really have improved much over time. So you've got an improvement that's probably partly due to more early diagnosis, and treatment of the early stage cancer does seem to be more effective, but not so that the area to target in terms of treatment would obviously be the late stage cancers. Or if you can try and avoid diagnosing them, then you can treat them. If you diagnose them earlier, they will be treatable. Which is perhaps an argument for screening, because you can treat the early stage cancers. You can't treat the later stage cancers as well.
For some reason, there's a big improvement in survival rates for stage 1 known.
I've no idea what's going on there. It could be a change in registry geography that we picked up over.
Okay.
Certain amount of outliers. These are very small numbers. Probably because we stage over 90% of breast cancers, so these are extremely small numbers.
Okay. So in fact, the smooth.
So probably what happened is a number of cancers that should have been staged crept in here,
Right, so in fact there's an implication there that the smoothness of these curves is perhaps an artifact.
They are rolling averages, which will create a lot of smoothing.
If there were small numbers of cases, they would be jumping up.
Well, indeed. I think there's a small number of cases with smoothing on the years. It is a surprisingly smooth curve, considering how much some of the other ones oscillate in a way. I don't know is the answer. But it would be better to see the data as a comp project. Prostate, we've only staged since 1999, so we've got a much shorter curve, shorter period, and we basically find that overall survival has improved, stage 1 and stage 2 of survival have improved, stage 4 probably hasn't much, and we've got here the stage not known has dropped off probably because we've got better, we've staged more and more. Part of this improvement, certainly in the improvement in stage 1s with extensive PSA testing, there will be a lot of cases have come and been diagnosed a lot earlier, basically a simple lead time bias, that cancers that would not have manifested themselves until way in the future are being picked up at this stage. And I think the indolent period for prostate cancer from sort of first potential diagnosis to, if you like, physical symptoms, something like 11 years. So we're in rather silly areas here, but we're having one 11-year period there. But anyway. And yes, it starts to get a bit, some of this I really don't know what's going on here. But let's try and concentrate on the latter part of the curve where our stage completeness is better and we're more there. Basically stage 1 and stage 2 are improving rapidly. Overall survival is improving, but what is particularly marked is the extent. You remember in breast cancer stage 3 survival was not improving. In colorectal cancer it very definitely is, it's actually crossed over the all survival line, and that's interesting, and I will come back to that. Any suggestions? You eyewitness, right?
It's not screen, is it?
Sorry?
Not screen.
Not really. I mean, no, bowel screenings only come in, it's all after this anyway, so we haven't got, screening doesn't come in. We're getting to the stage of being able to start to detect the effect of screening, but only just.
Is there any differences in surgical procedures?
There's an element of that in it.
When I look at some of these slopes, I look at them and think they're not remarkable, and it kind of makes you wonder how well all these very expensive therapies that have come onto the market over the past year are actually...
Well, it is quite alarming, actually. I mean, the fact that you haven't got any survival in the advanced stage breast cancer, which is all those ones are aimed at, what's going on?
Yeah.
A bit worrying. Or what are the drug companies doing apart from making money?
We're not doing a great deal of that.
but if you look...
Make more money if they did.
Sorry, what?
If you look at the figures 30 years ago now, quite a lot of the curves have gone up for breast cancer and several prostate, several others. Just one or two haven't.
Yeah.
But I mean, they represent a lot of people.
Yeah.
And from 80% to stage 1 up to 97%. Mm. That's a huge improvement, actually.
Oh, yes, yeah. It's just in some situations there doesn't seem to be what you expect, I mean, overall there's a definite improvement. It's just that there are sections of the cohort that you'd expect there might be an improvement where perhaps there aren't.
And you're saying it's the late stage ones?
In breast, for example. I mean, you've got stage 3 colorectal, right? Stage 1 is something's happening now.
You've got another question?
In those graphs, what does stage not known mean? For example, a person with stage 1 could be in stage not known, maybe?
Well, yeah, I mean, we... Basically, they should all be staged, but it is... We can't get hold of sufficient data to identify the stage of the cancer. The sort of situation where that... You'd expect that to arise is where it would be truly not known if there's a clinical diagnosis of, say, a prostate cancer in a very old person and no further work is done to identify the stage. But having said that, we might not have been able to get the data from the hospital, so that it's going to be slightly polluted by ones where they are stageable, but we don't know the stage. But hopefully that's getting less.
If you mask those people, can you actually impute their stage? I don't know, probably...
We haven't in this thing. We have done it in various studies using multiple imputation. But we have a target this year of staging 80% of all cancers, which effectively means some cancers are not stageable. Things like brain tumours, bone sarcomas, bone cancers are not stageable because they're not defined cancers in the way that epithelial cancers, skin sort of cancers located in the epithelial layer, breast cancers, colorectal cancers, are stageable. So achieving 80% staging will mean being well over 90% for the sites that we can stage. So basically we're trying to get to a stage where there really aren't very many. Yes?
Out of all the people who have cancer, do you know what percentage of them are on each of the stages?
Sorry?
Out of all the people who have cancer, what percentage of them are on each stage?
I didn't actually put that here. Breast cancer would be about, it's about 35% stage 1, 40% stage 2, probably 20% stage 3, 10% stage 4, and the rest unknown. I'm not sure what I opened up to actually find
right. Over this long time period, do those percentages change?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah. So I was just wondering, it's a totally sort of separate issue, but I was trying to think of a good way of showing those graphs and associating with each curve an indication of
the stage
what percentage
it
represents at each year.
Yeah, basically you can infer that to some extent by comparing the relative slopes of the survival curves.
Maybe.
To some extent. But yes, it's a fair point. It's quite difficult to get that much information.
Yeah. It would be a good project for a graphics designer. Because it's a very important piece of information.
Yes, yeah.
And insofar, for instance, as you say, a lot of the big swings on the stage not known curve can
yes,
be put
that,
down.
Yes, that would certainly help to explain that one.
Yeah, yeah.
But in breast cancer, I mean, screening was introduced in a major way during the period, time period covered from 1981 onwards.
Yeah.
So that must have affected the percentages in each stage 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah. That's right. Prostate cancer. On to the last one, which is lung cancer is what's particularly odd about that one. Look at the all stage survival curve, it's absolutely flat, and all the individual stage ones are either flat or moving up.
So your numbers and proportions won't actually account for this one.
Well,
because you haven't got none of the curves are moving downwards. None of the lines are moving downwards.
There's a bit of an argument for stage four, but not much.
No. Well, yeah, possibly. And there are quite a lot of stage fours, actually. But anyway.
So things are getting a little bit better even for the lung cancer patients?
No, they're not getting better at all for lung cancer. They're getting better for lung cancer as an individual stage, but they're not getting better for lung cancer overall, so survival by stage is not terribly useful here.
Right.
Because if you look at survival by stage, it gets better, but if you look at survival for everybody, it actually doesn't get better.
How can that happen? It's getting better.
Yeah.
Right, sorry.
It's because survival doesn't mean quite what it says.
No. This is known as the Will Rogers phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
And who was a comedian philosopher. And basically, I believe that Amgen is a Californian company, so you can throw me out of the building now. But apparently in the 1930s, they were thought to be so thick in California that even when the least intelligent people left Oklahoma, they arrived in California, raised the intelligence of the Californian population, and because they're gone, they raised the intelligence of the Oklahoman population as well. Whether that's true, I have no idea.
Same story is told of New Zealanders going to Australia.
And this is the sort of mathematical thing, and basically staging is done by what you can measure, and techniques for measuring change. So it's impossible actually to stage to be an entirely static picture.
There's a related story of two Cambridge dogs in the train to London. One of them telling the other that one of his colleagues, whom they both knew, had moved to Oxford. Ah, said the other, that's to the benefit of both institutions.
I presume that would be a Cambridge statement rather than...
Oh, it's definitely a Cambridge statement, yes.
Well, precisely.
Yes.
Yeah. He didn't suggest I use that example. Quote the one that's actually, because this came in a paper in New England Journal of Medicine, where basically the authors felt that things were changing in staging in terms of technique. So they took a cohort of cases in 1977 and staged them by the methods that they would have used more than 10 years before, i.e. they didn't have radioisotope mapping. They didn't have ultrasound, they didn't have various techniques for staging. So what they found was that, looking at the old staging methods, basically they found these are the numbers of survivors. So 32 out of 42 stage 1 cases, i.e. 76% survival, staging by the old method. If they then looked at all the other data, these basically moved only half the stage 1 cohort, or only slightly more than half the stage 1 cohort, 24, actually remained within stage 1. One progressed, one was restaged to stage 2, one was restaged to stage 3. So if you're using the new staging methods, the survival for stage 1 went up from 76 to 92%. With the stage 2s, some remain in stage 2, some went down to stage 3. So again, the stage 2 survival went up from 68% to 72%. And stage 3 survival, because it had gained some of the, although they're the worst survivors from these ones, they would be better survival than this lot, that lot went up as well. But the overall survival remained exactly the same. This is only 6 months survival, which is relatively high.
And this is only considering the ones who were in the system at the start and not taking account of migration into the system.
No, this is simply stages. Using different staging, not different staging methods, but different diagnostic techniques to contribute to the stage.
Right.
The staging methods were precisely the same, if you like. You would say that something, you would say that these ones were had no positive nodes, or the tumour hadn't spread a certain distance, and you used the other diagnostic methods, you found that actually the tumour had spread more than you thought it had, and so on. And so what happened here was that to identify positive nodes and different metastases, they use this delightful technique called PET-CT scanning, where they give people a dose of positrons, and they get, and these all head off towards rapidly growing tissue, i.e. nodes with cancer growth in, metastases with cancer growth, and you then put them in a CT with a marker and they light up. And they're also not very nice to know for a few hours afterwards because they're emitting all kinds of nasty radiation that get dried out very quickly. I never thought when I was younger that there'd be a use for positrons.
No.
But there you are. So basically there's been an awful lot of upstaging of cancers. And the colorectal situation is sort of, that's your example of surgical technique. Basically what happened was that in earlier years surgeons were not taking out as complete a sample, and pathologists were not looking at as large a sample, so they were not detecting cancer spread, basically. So once they changed their surgical techniques, they got more lymph nodes, they got more complete excision of the tumour, they found more spread of the tumour, and a lot of these tumours were upstaged. So this, and you've got some cases which would have been stage 1 or 2 were moving to stage 3, so improving the survival of all the stages using the same mechanism. I'm pretty well here at the end now. I'm at the end. And as well as over time, you can get confusions over space, if you like, cross-sectional confusions. It so happened that Adam Brooks, being a sort of very, very research-oriented institution, got an experimental PET-CT scanner, but they used it. It was used for routine diagnosis as well. And this is what you get here. You look at. I happened to, and this took me completely surprised. I wonder what this is. Some work I did on what on earth was going on. Why are people in Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire, and Peterborough, those ones, doing better than those in the east, when you're north of Suffolk?
Yeah.
We didn't think that there were any differences, and then I sort of realised that these ones have been staged using PET-CT scanning. Norfolk and Norwich, which is the lung centre for there, did not have a PET-CT scanner at the time. And you've got this sort of spurious difference in what is a perfectly sort of reasonable analysis to make. But you need to know what your data means. And I think that's really about it.
Wow.
So thank you very much.
Oh yes. Perhaps the best dirty data you can get, but so Any further questions?
Yeah. Can I ask a meta question?
Yes.
You said in your biography that you went into this because nobody here was interested in doing agricultural research, which, as you know, is quite similar to my own career trajectory.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you think the impact, this is a question about a hypothetical cohort, how do you think the impact of this work on people's lives compares with the kind of jobs that we might have had if we'd found what we were looking for in the in the early 90s?
It's an interesting one. I was very interested actually in producing sort of in inverted commas nice tasting foods of higher nutritional quality, so I don't know is the answer.
Nor do I.
And we were interested actually in producing anti you know, sort of anti-cancer tomatoes as well, so it all gets a bit in the bread. I don't know.
Mm.
Nick, I'm not sure. It would have been quite a long haul on the agricultural side. I think it probably would have been slower.
Yeah, this seems to me fairly high impact. You know, it's
I think it would have. I mean, potentially greater impact in. Well, I don't know. Potentially greater impact in the longer term. I don't know.
Do we have any viewing parties?
Yeah, I think in this country, you know, but I suppose I moved to Australia at about the same time, trying to find somewhere where agricultural research could have an impact. But if you're going to do it in this country, I suspect that this kind of work has a higher impact than what one might have done in agriculture.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was sort of moving more towards food than agriculture. I mean, the two are obviously closely related, but there was... I mean, sort of, yes, agriculture's got a bit divorced from food, really, isn't it, kind of? It's, you perhaps need to bring those two together.
Mm. Which is perhaps happening now, the sort of emphasis on local sourcing.
Yeah.
Well, that's related to a question I've been intending to bring up right from the beginning, which is, are you also following, tracking the incidence of different types of cancer according to place, like environment?
Well, I mean, only in terms of only geographically, we don't have...
So it's coarse.
Sorry?
It's coarse classification.
Yes, it is. I mean, we would...
So you wouldn't distinguish necessarily between Norwich City and the Norfolk Broads?
We could do.
You could.
But the trouble is it gets to very small populations.
Yes.
I mean... We could do analyses. I mean, we've got measures from the location of how urban areas are and so on, so it is possible to do analysis by measures of
I mean, one thing, for instance,
rurality
in urban areas, because of exhaust emissions from vehicles, possibly lung cancer is more likely. But in rural areas where there's intensive agriculture and agrochemicals can be distinctly harmful.
Well, that's right, I mean, to be honest, there's such a small proportion of the populations involved in agriculture that,
there are quite a few people live in small towns or villages.
Yes, who should be, you know, sort of... Yeah, I mean, we get sort of requests for cancer clusters, and there was one where the Ministry of Defence in the 50s, early 50s, I think, decided that they wanted to look at the potential spread of radiation from a nuclear explosion. So they decided, cadmium is nice and inert. So we'll drop it out of an aeroplane over Norwich, and we'll puff it out of a van over Bedfordshire. And we had some requests on that the one in Norfolk was clearly causing a major outbreak of esophageal cancer. We basically discovered that the cluster was two brothers in one house in Great Yarmouth, so that was probably more genetic. And we didn't find anything in Bedfordshire. But, you know, these things.
And that reminds me that the National Defence also carried out a similar exercise involving sarin type nerve gas in Norfolk, Norfolk. They sprayed it along the line, which I think would be well need Kings Lynn and Bedfordshire.
Why?
Well, they just wanted to find out how it would disperse.
Well, at least they did think that cadmium was inert at the time.
You know, they don't know the other side, Turkey. But I think they hoped that, because it does dissipate, it gets hydrolyzed fairly quickly.
Yeah.
So it would only
be... Did
they
warn people not to be around when they did it?
Well, God knows what they arranged. But it's well documented.
Yeah.
There was Orford Mess as well, wasn't there, where they made atomic bomb parts. They made sure the other people didn't go there for many years.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Do you know if there exists data from 50 or 70 years ago, for example?
Not very much, I think is the answer. I mean, we go back, we've got some cases back to the 1960s or so, but we're very incomplete. I mean, basically, I sort of don't like going anything really earlier than 1985 just because of sort of messy data. Those curves went back to 1981. You see they were pretty sort of rough at the beginning end. Not really, I think, is the answer.
I thought maybe, I don't know, it's the extreme cases like in, what's it, in Iceland, because I know the... Basically, the computer, you type any two names, you can find out, you know, over the past 500 years or something,
yeah,
how they connect. The question here, well, probably it's difficult if you don't know, if you can identify whether these people are from one family, say, maybe in India or whatever.
I mean, we provide data for genetic counselors, we get requests from genetic counselors to find out whether their relatives had cancer and so on. So we do quite a lot of that, but it's a bit of a separate part. The Scandinavian countries are particularly good at this because they tend to have a single identity number, which is used for everything. So they know what people have done, they know everything about them, and that is, and they're relatively, I think most of the population in England actually is not that bothered about having, you know, their identities, but there's this group that sort of stymies it. So we can't work out what our people's occupations are. We can't get a lot of data which is in other systems because they don't have the same identifier. Our NHS number is our primary identifier. You know, our primary identifier. We obviously have their name, we know who they are.
That means a national insurance number as well.
Yeah. We don't have that. I don't think we're allowed to have that.
Right. Yeah. But the French also have a similar system, which the Livre de Famille system,
yeah,
whereby the parents have their children in their livre de famille, and it goes back up.
Yeah.
And when when you as an adult child marry someone else's adult child, the information in that marriage links back up, so that their libre de famille links back up.
Is that now stored electronically? Or?
I don't know. I think it goes back to pre-Napoleonic times.
Yeah. We might even go back to Napoleonic times, because a lot of things like that were introduced by the
Danish system seems to be working well. I've seen a number of papers recently based on the whole Danish population.
Yeah, and the bins are good too as well.
Anthony Edwards told me years ago, his wife is Swedish, in Sweden at that time they kept records of every phone call Sweden. This information was publicly available, and nobody felt that this was an invasion of their privacy.
Yeah. Could be that the volume of data was so big nobody could get
to it. I don't vouch for the authenticity of
Sweden. But I mean, so they certainly found it in Finland that there was association of testicular cancer in chainsaw users. Chainsaw oil, so squirting back.
But there's been quite a sea change in this country, because in Oxford they set up a record linkage where they could link episodes of hospital care for individuals, and that ran into terrible problems with the people you referred to as saying that this was an invasion of privacy and so forth. And so
I think we hope we should have the episode. We're expecting the full episode of hospital care data set to be linked up to the national cancer data set in the, I think, 5 weeks is what I was last told yesterday. Was I what I told yesterday? It's been 5 weeks since the beginning of the year, but hopefully we'll get there.
There's a movement by the Health and Social Care Information Centre to have at the centre person identifiable data so that they can link between all these different data sets.
Absolutely.
Hospital episodes, mental health act data, all sorts of stuff.
I mean, there are some that are very difficult, like the drug, you know, the drug use databases, the sexually transmitted disease databases and so on, which are, there are a lot of worries about identifiability in those, and perhaps sort of less of a major issue as far as we're concerned. I mean, the big one that we want to link up is GP data, but there isn't a single data set at the moment.
And I suspect the best of luck with some GPs databases.
Yeah, well, I think that they use a relatively limited number of systems.
They're not homogeneous.
No, that's right, exactly. They don't. I mean, having said that, in getting all those data together, we basically had to we had to write import routines for each single hospital, you know, to get their data, and they're not all the same either. And even if they're using the same system, the data doesn't come out the same.
No.
So it's not, you know, it needs an awful lot. You can't just plug the two together and something happens.
Or something will happen.
Or something. May not be identifiable.
Yes. Yeah.
But this also comes back to this, whether the data are recorded. I don't know if anybody's ever tried to do a randomised trial involving surgical procedures. Surgeons do not understand systematic collection of data, and it's extremely difficult, and you're dependent on that for a lot of your staging.
Yeah.
And so
the
hospitals may change, and that was why I raised the original question how consistent the data were when collected from different sources.
The only thing is that they want to get paid.
Yeah.
And
it's a great incentive to surgeons.
They basically get paid to some extent according to what they do, or at least the hospitals do, and so they sort of have to record them, and there's a fair amount of checking that they're
their sort of, you know, rates for a particular procedure are very much in line with everybody else's, that they're not sort of, you know, trying to put things down. But you see these things where they've decided that you've got one combined procedure and then actually putting two separate procedures in will get them more money, so they put in two separate procedures that actually didn't put at the same time. Maybe.
Right. So this adds noise to the data set.
Oh yes. But it's a big I mean, we think although there is noise in the data, that's probably sufficient size that the conclusions are probably reasonably valid.
But admitting that such things can and to some extent do happen, it then becomes a kind of randomization element that you could put into your model.
Yes.
Sort of a lurking random effects in.
Liam Smith, epidemiologist at the London School, goes on about that, doing effectively randomised trials by using the random element in how GPs allocate patients to treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yes.
Sort of, I don't know what to put you on, we'll try this type of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And given you kind of in situations where it's not ethical to do a trial, you use the fact that there is this element of randomness, you can get patients randomly allocated to different treatments because the GPs are uncertain.
Yeah, I think if you need to sort of specify very carefully the situation where there is uncertainty
yes,
in making
yes,
the decision.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you again very much. This could go on forever.